This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I would say it is pretty successful. We have been working now since 2015. We are going to be in 6 countries by the end of this year and developing working dog programs with wildlife authorities within governments in African countries.
That's Will Powell, director of the Canine for Conservation Program for the African Wildlife Foundation. Full details on the story coming up.
Also, a delegation headed by the foreign minister of Eritrea, Osman Saleh, is in Ethiopia for talks aimed at ending the long-standing animosity between the two neighbors. And Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni met yesterday with President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar in Khartoum in an effort to engage the two leaders to reach a peace agreement.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story, an Eritrean delegation headed by Foreign Minister Osman Saleh arrived today in Ethiopia for talks with the government. They aim to add momentum to moves to end the long-standing animosity between the two neighbors. The talks follow the recent surprise announcement by Ethiopia's new prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, that he would withdraw from disputed territory. That's been the key sticking point, even though the area is sparsely populated. The optimism that Ahmed's move has sparked, along with other major reforms he's undertaking, has been tempered by an apparent assassination attempt at a massive weekend rally that he had just addressed. Joe Siegel is research director at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with my colleague Paul Alexander about the impact of the bombing and the prospects for peace.
The fact that it took place in the midst of this massive demonstration in support of new Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is, I think, powerful both for the symbolism, but also to underscore that there are, some elements within Ethiopian society that are, threatened by the changes that he is bringing to the country. Now, we don't know, who is behind this, and, I think at this point we're just speculating, but, there could be some disgruntled political domestic actors, there could be some external actors that don't want to see him really consolidate, the various forces within Ethiopia and really champion some of the reforms that he's been promoting.
So what do the recent moves toward a rapprochement with Eritrea mean on the ground, and why is this being done now?
I think the rapprochement we're seeing in Eritrea really reflects the opportuneness of the moment. So much of that Ethiopia-Eritrea conflict, when it comes down to it, it was about pride and about face-saving among the leaders at the time, Isaias Afwerki and Eritrea, and Meles Zenawi, a former prime minister in Ethiopia. And it seems like both sides realize that this is a unique opportunity, and I think they just take their time. They talk through the details, and they can work out the mechanics of this on the ground. And if they're able to do so, I think it opens up all kinds of opportunities for both sides. Certainly from a security standpoint, it reduces an important flashpoint along the border, so that it's going to reduce the security requirements and resources that have been mobilized on both sides on the border. But, economically, there's great opportunities because with Eritrea's independence, Ethiopia lost its access to ports on the Red Sea. And so Assab is a very natural throughway for a lot of Ethiopian products, Massawa as well for northern Ethiopia. And both sides would benefit enormously from reopening up those ports and some of the trade that can take place. I think more than any substantive issues, it's a whole different dynamic of trust that can be rebuilt. And with that, there'll be greater cooperation for regional security, regional economic cooperation. It could lead to the reduction in isolation of Eritrea.
Considering the other conflicts in the region, do you think that there's the possibility that a successful resolution of this situation or failure to resolve it could be contagious?
You know, I think stability begets stability, and instability fosters more instability. So if you reduce this tension, it can only help the region. And again, to the extent that there was any support for non-state actors that were undermining other governments in the region, I think those things will be reduced. I would temper the expectation that the resolution of the Eritrea-Ethiopia border dispute is going to dramatically change the dynamics in Somalia or South Sudan. I think those conflicts are driven by other dynamics, largely internal to those countries.
That was Joe Siegel of the African Center for Strategic Studies in Washington. He was speaking with reporter Paul Alexander.
A Ugandan official says he is optimistic that South Sudan's warring parties will soon end the nearly five-year-old conflict. A spokesman for the Ugandan government says President Yoweri Museveni met yesterday with President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar in Khartoum and will continue to engage the two leaders to reach a peace agreement. Mugume Davis Rawakaringi reports from Kampala.
Ugandan government spokesman Ofwono Pondo told reporters in Kampala today Uganda welcomes efforts by President Kiir and Machar to resolve their differences face-to-face.
They have agreed to continue meeting. Now, we hope that this meeting in Addis Ababa and in Khartoum paves the way for them either to choose task forces to deal with each sticky issue and also deal with schedule. How do we cascade the negotiations over the different issues and resolve them?
President Kiir and Machar first met in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, last week but failed to reach an agreement on outstanding issues. The two met in Khartoum yesterday. During his opening remarks, President Kiir said he wants to end the suffering of South Sudanese people and is willing to compromise to reach a deal with Machar. Both men expressed hope for a breakthrough. A communique issued by Regional Bloc IGAD after the Addis meeting calls for President Omar Hassan al-Bashir to facilitate a second round of direct talks between Kiir and Machar to build on what was discussed in Addis. It is hoped that Kiir and Machar will work out the disagreements over governance and security arrangements. In a separate session, delegates from Sudan and South Sudan will also discuss economic cooperation between the two countries. The IGAD communique says they will also, in two quotes, discuss measures to be taken to rehabilitate the South Sudanese economy through bilateral cooperation between the Republic of South Sudan and the Republic of Sudan, end quotes. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is expected to host yet another round of talks between the two leaders in the weeks ahead. Opondo says Uganda and the region as a whole worries about the South Sudanese who have become refugees as a result of nearly 5 years of fighting.
In our case, over 1.4 million South Sudanese are in Uganda as refugees, and they're straining our resources. We would want those people to go sooner than later. And therefore, our president, our government, is putting all effort to ensure that the new impetus in mediation does not collapse once again.
The conflict has displaced more than 4 million people from their homes. About half of them have sought refuge in neighboring countries. Opondo says, as a neighbor, Uganda wants to see a stable South Sudan.
At the end of the day, what do we want in South Sudan? An effective government, preferably a government that is legitimate, that is accepted by all. An effective government means a government that is capable of protecting the people of South Sudan in South Sudan.
Opondo says Uganda will continue to engage the two leaders, whether at peace talks or on the sidelines of other international and regional meetings, to bring to an end the fighting. For VOA News, Ayamogume, Davis Ruakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Conservationists are taking a huge bite out of wildlife trafficking with the use of sniffer dog handler units. The African Wildlife Foundation's Canines for Conservation program is showing great progress in Botswana, Uganda, Kenya, Mozambique, and Tanzania. I recently attended a presentation on the current wildlife trafficking crisis in Africa and the critical role that dog and human teams play in removing live animals and wildlife products such as ivory, rhino horn, and pangolin scales from the lucrative black market. Will Powell is the director of the program. He spoke with me about the impact the program is having in Africa.
I would say it is pretty successful. We have been working now since 2015. We are going to be in 6 countries by the end of this year and developing working dog programs with wildlife authorities within governments in African countries. And the places that we're working, we are seeing a real change in patterns of and a reduction in trafficking in certain key locations where we're working. Not to say that we're not stopping trafficking completely. We are changing the routes and putting pressure on the whole business. So I would say for the scale that we are at, which is still a small scale, we are pretty successful.
In your presentation, you mentioned that the busts that do occur, they end up being arrested and other people prosecuted. Do they go to prison?
When we started the program originally in 2015, there were cases we would find ivory and the people would get away with it. Corruption would take place and they would escape. But since we have a program of working with judiciary and training prosecutors in the countries where we work, we've had a better increase in arrests and cases going all the way to court and people being either locked up or fined heavily for having illegal wildlife products.
Also, you talked about one key feature of impeding the trafficking is the slowing the demand. So how do you go about doing that?
So that's another part of AWF's sort of bigger picture, and that is spending a lot of time in the Far East, in China, working with media outlets from China. There's a zoo that we're working with to try and educate people and to change the sort of the thinking and understanding of what happens to an elephant when the tusks are taken off. In the old days, you used to think that a lot of Chinese people would think that tusks would grow back and that the animals were not killed. The sort of education that we're doing now, it's beginning to see some changes. It's still a huge challenge. I mean, it's still a business which isn't slowing down enough. There's still 20 to 30,000 elephant killed every year in Africa, and probably around 3 rhino are killed every day. So we still have a long way to go, but we're beginning to see some change.
You mentioned that Cameroon is very challenging. So why is it so challenging, and what do you have in store for Cameroon?
The problem is the sort of lack of infrastructure and systems in place to try and curb the crime. There is a certain level of corruption and disorganization which allows the spaces for the traffickers to move relatively freely. Again, it's a hub, it's a conduit from other parts of Western Central Africa. Stuff travels from Western Central Africa into Cameroon and then out of Yaoundé and Douala. It's definitely challenging, but we're working very closely with the ministry, who are very much on sides, and we're really optimistic about having some impact.
You mentioned in looking ahead some of your strategies, and one was the self-sustaining model. Can you explain what that is?
Our program, we have a dog school, which is based in northern Tanzania, where I live. And, we have the facilities and the staff to carry on training more than just conservation dogs. The plan is to get back into the security business and to train up and sell or lease very sort of high-level security dog teams. And then all the profits from the security teams will go back into conservation. So we're using the same guys that we use for our conservation dogs, who are originally from a security background. We're there anyway. We may as well kickstart our security business again and begin to get the whole program self-sustainable to a certain extent. In some countries, it's quite an expensive operation to run, but if we can cover at least some of our costs, it's quite exciting.
Will Powell is the director of the African Wildlife Foundation's Canines for Conservation program. He spoke with me in Washington.
20 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Police moved in on Paris University early today to remove dozens of migrants and activists who had been living there since the beginning of the year. Police say over 190 people were taken to a gym to have their applications processed, while another 160 illegal occupants were removed from Paris 8 University, north of the capital. Many of the migrants come from West Africa, Sudan, and Eritrea. Prior to occupying the university buildings, many of the migrants had been living on the streets. Catherine Field is covering the story from Paris. She gave our colleague William Eagle the latest.
It was before dawn that riot police moved into the Paris 8 University, which is in the north of the city. Police had been called in by the university's administrators to clear out some 194 migrants, mostly young men, who have been sheltering there since late January. Now, most of these young men were from West Africa, Sudan, or Eritrea, and they have been essentially living there. They moved there at the depths of winter because they needed somewhere safe and somewhere warm to live. They had food, they had bedding. They were also taking lessons. They were learning French from some of the students who were using the classrooms there. They have now been moved to a gymnasium to the east of the city, and there their papers will be checked. The state official there, the prefect, has said that within the next 48 hours, all of these migrants will have their papers checked, and they will each be allowed to either apply for asylum or refugee status, and they will have their cases seen to.
Speaking of having their papers checked, Macron has recently passed stricter rules regarding the deportation or acceptance for asylum of these migrants. Can you tell me a bit about that, especially how he sees and treats economic migrants?
Monsieur Macron, the president, has also made it clear that there will be appeals, that these appeals will be heard. Again, though, it will be a much quicker appeal process than in the past. I mean, there were complaints in the past that sometimes the appeal process could take up to 2 years, which the president said when he went and met some of these migrants up in Calais, he said that just wasn't fair on them, that they were just left there wandering around.
Are there discussions now to create registration or transit centers in Africa or even in some European countries? And is this something that will be discussed by EU leaders this week?
Indeed, there has been talk of creating these reception centers or disembarkation centers that are outside of the European Union. And that would be a, if you like, a camp or a settlement where migrants could go. They could be taken there if they're rescued at sea or intercepted at sea on some of these boats. And there they would be allowed to stay there while their papers are being processed. Now, the problem with all this is that who would manage these particular resettlement or disembarkation camp? Would it be, as the European Union is hoping, the UNHCR and the IOM? But again, NGOs such as Amnesty International have come up with the question of under which jurisdiction would these resettlement or welcome centres be set up? And at a time when different European countries have different legislation regarding migration, different legislation regarding who can claim asylum, well, they say that what actually would happen and what rules would be in place to distinguish economic migrants from those who actually do need international protection. So that is one problem that is still not being, no solutions have come forward on that. The other question, which of course is, can you have these centres really outside of Europe? And that means to the south of Europe, perhaps on the Mediterranean. Italy has suggested perhaps these camps could be set up in southern Libya, which would then stop migrants from going across the Libyan desert and making it to the Mediterranean. Other possibilities, of course, are perhaps Niger, where the French have already got some sort of disembarkation centre there, which they are using. At the moment, though, the question is who would look after these migrants if they were there, and under which jurisdiction would their application for protection be considered?
That was reporter Catherine Field in Paris. She was speaking with VOA's William Eagle.
Tension continues in three local government areas in Plateau State in central Nigeria. The violence involves herders who are largely Muslim and farmers who are mostly Christian. A group known as the Mayete Allah Cattle Breeders Association of Nigeria has described the recent killings by suspected herdsmen as retaliatory. Authorities say over 85 people have been killed in the attacks. Reporter Gift Agariga from Abuja, Nigeria, has more.
Abubakar Gambo is the secretary and spokesperson for the Mayete Allah in Barakinladi local government area of Plateau State. Mayete Allah is an advocacy group promoting the welfare of the Fulani people. He spoke exclusively to VOA on Monday as the fighting was continuing. He says the violence in Riom, Jos South, and Barakinladi local government areas were acts of retaliation by Fulani herdsmen against Berom youths accused of stealing cattle.
There has been a rustling of cattle. We are estimating about 500 cattle were lost by the Berom people. We've been complaining to the security because there was a day on this issue. We as Mayete Allah in Barakinladi local government and including the state escort of our Mayete Allah. We went to the station Safe Haven commander in Jos. We've been complaining to the security. Nothing was done.
As of Monday evening, Gambo said fighting was still ongoing, making people flee in panic. He says herders have asked security forces maintained in Plateau and parts of Bauchi states to help retrieve stolen livestock, but to no avail. A prominent civil rights group, Human Rights Writers Association of Nigeria, accuses the government of deliberately refusing to arrest the armed Fulani herdsmen for the violence in parts of Plateau state. The national coordinator of the association, Emmanuel Onwobiko, says the solution to the spate of killings rests squarely on the government.
We have consistently called on federal government to step up action against the sponsors and suspected killers who are suspected to be armed Fulani herdsmen. So we now say the government should declare Mayete Allah Cattle Owners Association a terrorist group, so that the government can take proper action to deal with this issue. Then on the Plateau killings, we condemn it absolutely. Nigeria has laws that completely outlaws mass murder. There's no reason why somebody should kill another citizen and that person who is responsible is not being arrested, is not being prosecuted, and is not being punished.
On Monday evening, Vice President of Nigeria, Professor Yemi Osinbajo, visited Plateau State. He offered condolences to the people and to the state officials following the deadly attack that claimed scores of lives over the weekend. He also arranged a meeting with leaders of different ethnic groups and government officials in Plateau State to ensure that peace returns to the troubled areas. Plateau State government already imposed a dusk till dawn curfew in the affected communities, saying the move was to avert a breakdown of law and order. Governor Simon Lalong said the measure will stay in effect until further notice. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, who is ethnically Fulani, called the violence painful and regrettable. He said the government will not rest until all murderers and criminal elements and their sponsors are incapacitated and brought to justice. Buhari's opponents say he is not doing enough to stop the fighting, which has been going on sporadically for several years. Since the beginning of the year, there have been killings in neighboring Benue State. In January, fighting between farmers and herdsmen killed 72 people, and 3 months later, 19 people were killed in an attack on a church. Some attribute the fighting to climate change, which drives mostly Fulani pastoralists southward into lands held by farmers from other ethnic groups. Buhari blames the killings on an influx of armed men and herders trained by Libya's security services under that country's former ruler, Muammar Gaddafi. He says one solution would be to establish designated grazing areas or ranches for the livestock, an idea farmers say could mean taking their lands. Observers say the violence will likely become an issue in the presidential election scheduled next year. Since 2009, fighting in between herdsmen and farmers have killed over 20,000 people, more than the Boko Haram terrorists active in northeastern Nigeria. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.